because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Leads the country in offensive rebounding.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver, the founder, CEO, and creative mind behind basketballimmersion.com. This is the podcast where you will hear real basketball coaching conversations. Whether you are a new or experienced coach at any level of basketball, these coaching conversations will give you practical ideas to stimulate your coaching and make what you do even better. Without any more delay, let's share the game. Excited today to have Brad Campbell, head coach of the University of Western men's basketball program and a longtime friend of mine. And Brad and I had the wonderful opportunity to be able to coach a professional team from Canada that went to play in the Jones Cup. The Jones Cup is a tournament that takes place in Taiwan. It's the 40th year for the tournament. And it was a first-time experience for both Brad and I in the sense that we got to coach internationally a Canadian team. And you know, we come away with a wonderful experience, and we wanted to share some of the things that we learned and some of the insights that we got from that tournament with you today. Brad, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's great to be here. Listen to quite a few of your podcasts, and they're outstanding, and just excited to participate in one and talk about this Jones Cup experience.
Well, Brad and I will get into that. And I think one of the unique things about Brad and I is that we both came up through coaching together in very similar ways that, you know, we coached a lot of different types of teams and learned coaching through coaching and became friends through that experience. And even though we're technically rivals, we've remained good friends. I think that's fair to say, Brad.
Yeah, no, you're bang on. It's people may find that a little bit strange that we're friends through this whole thing, but definitely we've known each other for a long time and all those teams and getting up through the system and coaching club teams and high school teams. And it's been an amazing journey. And, you know, we've stayed friends through all that. So it's been amazing.
Well, and that's what led us to this opportunity to be on the same coaching staff at the Jones Cup. And I first off have to say, for me, the number one part of the experience was actually having Brad on staff, because coaches know, even though I'm a university coach, I don't have a full-time assistant. So I've never really had, I would say I've had great helpers, but I've never had someone that's been able to invest as much in basketball as I have. And having you there, Brad, it was a huge load off my shoulders. It was just tremendous to be able to have you involved. And let's start with that. What were your first experiences and impressions of that experience at the Jones Cup after returning home and reflecting on it?
Yeah, I mean, what a ride that was. Thinking on that tournament and reflecting on it, I think two key things that really struck me about that tournament is, one, what a marathon it was. I mean, you and I, when we get involved in a tournament at our level of play, it's usually a weekend. We're usually playing a 3 games in 3 days type of scenario. And to play 8 games in 9 days and be down there an extra day. So I guess we were down there for 10 days, technically. I think at one point I remember we were talking about it. I think we were on day 6 and I was like, wow, this is taking a long time. And we still got 2 more games left, I think, at that point. And it was exciting. And, you know, you're fired up. And obviously, we had a chance to win the tournament at that point. And the juices are flowing and just excited about the whole experience and the fans and the culture. And dealing with our players was amazing, too. And just the length of time it was taking, it just kind of hit me over the head, I think, at that point, which was a little wild. But the whole adrenaline and the rush of the tournament, I think, helped get you through the whole thing. I don't know about you if you felt that way as well.
Well, I felt like we'd coach, we'd eat, and we'd coach again. Everything was revolving around either a shoot around or some video and a game or eating, which was, yeah, was obviously, it was a positive. The food was tremendous and the hospitality was incredible. And just give coaches a quick background. This Canada 3D global team that came together, again, grateful for the experience. We essentially had 3 practices prior to leaving, and that was just the logistics of getting players throughout our country together to be able to be at a training camp. So we had training camp before we left. And then in Taiwan, we played 8 games in 9 days. And if I remember, our 6th game was the day off was after that, after the 6th game, right?
Yep.
It came down to the last game where We went 7-1. We lost to Korea, and we needed some help the last day, or it could have been a two-way tie or a three-way tie. And everything worked out for us to be able to win the tournament, which was amazing. But talking about the length of the tournament, what are some factors that you felt now after reflection are really important when considering putting together a team for such a short type of tournament like that?
Well, to play 8 games in 9 days takes an amazing toll on your team and your players. Who really cares about the coaching staff at that point, as you mentioned? But just the fact that we were very lucky, I think, overall, not to really have any significant injury to anyone. Our guys, obviously, their bodies were beat up by the end, but to stay relatively fresh and healthy, I think, was a huge key to us playing at a high level throughout that tournament. You know, watching some other teams play during the course of the tournament, it was interesting when scouting them. They sometimes sat a few guys on some games and they changed up their rotations. Maybe that was philosophy of because of the length of the tournament, they wanted to keep guys a little bit fresher and not wear them down. Maybe they had some injuries that we didn't, and that caused some different strategy changes on their part.
Well, it could have been that, and it could have been also that we talked about as well. It could have been for development of certain players. We talked specifically about Korea in sitting their American player, their naturalized citizen, in some games. And sometimes that may be because they want to rest them. But I think often it was just they wanted to develop the rest of their players. And when he was on the floor, he was the focal point. And when he was off the floor, maybe other players were more focal.
Well, yeah, and I think it became probably very pro-like in the way that almost at the end of a pro season where you're probably not practicing very much, you're just going over some things. And you have to have a quality of player with probably a high IQ. I mean, we were going through quite a few things, but not a whole lot of court time other than that shoot time we'd get in the morning. And some of those days, we never even had a shoot time. So it was just a meeting, or you were sending out some video, or we'd send out some notes. Obviously, all the games were on local TV, so our guys themselves could watch the games, but also some video things that we had done and notes and just scouting reports. So a lot of it was just taking it in at some points without actually getting on the court. A few times, remember, we would show up to the venue early where we maybe didn't have a shoot. And for 20 minutes, some of our guys were in flip-flops on the floor, and we were going through just some things that the other team might be doing, some actions that they may be running, just to get some information to our players that may help us coming up in the game quickly. So they're very quick turnover on things. We had to turn the page real quick in some games, especially those games where we played. We had a few games where we played in the evening, either at like 5 or 7 p.m., and then we had to turn around the next day and play at 1 in the afternoon the next day. Those were challenging because our shoot time might be at 8 a.m. on those days. So it was just, I remember we were constantly tweaking schedules all the time. We would go in with an idea of, okay, here's the next day's schedule. And then we'd get to that evening before the next day and go, okay, no, we got to scrap that. We got to change this. We got to put this schedule in. We're going to have to change this time over here. We're going to have to eat at this time, just because either talking to the players on our team or the coaching staff, we had to adapt on the fly very quickly from a scheduling standpoint. And, you know, trying to get ahead from a scouting standpoint when you're just playing a game the next day constantly, it was nice. And that obviously, and we talked about it too, our schedule worked out very nicely where we played, it was 5 games, right? And then we had the day off. We played six games and then we had the day off and then played the last two. So actually, I think that schedule worked out very favorably for us in that manner.
Again, I think these parallels that we're talking about apply a lot to high school and AAU coaches in particular, because, again, they have shorter seasons. They have to get right to the point, so to speak. They don't have a lot of time for fluff and all these different things. But I think the other part of that is that you're dealing with so many other variables that we were very conscious of not overwhelming our players with too many shoots, too many meetings, all these different things that you or I may do a little bit, a lot more of maybe with our own team in shorter preparation weekends or even things like that. And we were very conscious of not controlling our players. And I don't know if that would have changed for me if it was college kids or high school kids. Probably not, because I do believe that you need your downtime. You need your personal time as a player away from too many meetings and too many film sessions and too much basketball, so to speak. But certainly with the pro players, it worked out for us. Really just focus in on maximizing their time and not wasting their time.
Well, yeah, and I think a lot of it too was just the constant communication we had with our players. Like, what do you think? Here's what we're thinking of doing the next day. What's your feedback? We needed their feedback, and we went a lot just on what the information they were giving us. Do you want to shoot the next morning? Do you think we can is it too early? Can we handle it? We're going to get to the gym early and go through some things. Yeah, no, that's good. So just the constant communication with them to try and get some feedback. What's good? What's cool? What can we work with? I think to switching a little bit of a theme from my standpoint, what was really interesting over the course of that tournament was, and I think was outstanding for me, to be an assistant coach. I mean, I've been a head coach at Western now for, I think it's like 13 or 14 years I'm going into. And to go back to the assistant role, I was an assistant coach at Western for 9 years. And to go back into that role was something I really enjoyed. And it was an amazing eye-opener again, just to move again down that seat on the bench, one spot, just the different elements of being an assistant coach and helping you with things throughout the game and options and evaluating. It's amazing how much different that perspective is. And having not been in it for a long length of time, I think was invigorating a little bit. It was nice to see. And it was something that I'm not sure how much you would agree with this or get, because again, you're still in that head coaching role. But at home, when I'm at Western as a head coach, I've got into a bit of a role where I'm pretty comfortable setting my mind on a few things. I'm looking at the offense. I'm looking at matchups. Our assistant coaches at my place have various roles. And then when slipping back into that assistant coaching position, I found that there was way more things on my plate to a certain extent. We had all kinds of other influences out there on our team as well in terms of media and some other things and the tournament itself going on. I'm trying to help you with options. We have a few other assistant coach dealing with some other things. So it was really fascinating for me. And it was really a great piece to get back and set in that kind of role, which I enjoyed tremendously.
Well, and let's talk about that, because essentially the way I framed it for you was, give me as much as you think about in the moments and like, just keep constantly send me information. And essentially, again, some staffs at the college or NBA level, they would have more specific roles, like you said, focusing on one thing. But you were essentially my assistant and you focused on everything. And I just said, give me everything you see. And then I'll process it and I'll see what I think is good. And I think other than calling timeouts, I think I listen to you pretty much all the time. So we definitely know my philosophy on timeouts is not to call them. But we can talk about that later. But what advice now would you have for assistant coaches, or as a head coach, what advice would you give to an assistant to say, this is how you can be a more productive assistant? And really, we're talking within a game, because you and I, we didn't have that much practice to really define it. And just so coaches know, Brad ran the defense and I ran the offense. But what are some suggestions you have for people to be better assistants for their head coach?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would say from a game standpoint, like we're talking about, so whatever role you've had defined from the head coach as your assistant job is come in prepared with some ideas, obviously, and then throughout the game, what I found interesting too throughout the game is I had my little notepad and I had it organized in a few different sections. I had kind of an offensive section, suggestions for you and ideas. I had defensive matchups and section. So, you know, obviously I was a little bit more defensive oriented, but I also wanted to give you some offensive options. And then one thing I always do is, you know, and maybe it's the result of coaching some teams over the years that from an offensive standpoint didn't really have the talent to kind of go get buckets on their own, is always from a system standpoint, okay, what are some little subtleties in our system that maybe are able to get us a cheap bucket in the fourth quarter? You know, where's a little slip, or where's a little piece of action we can just change or tweak a little bit that might give us a cheap basket when we're really struggling maybe in that fourth quarter to score, or their defense is locked in on some things. I was always trying to put down a few options for you to give in that regard, because that's always stuff that I look for. So, and part of my job, I thought in that tournament was, there'd be a timeout called by either team. You never called hardly any of them, so it was always the other team calling the timeout.
Well, sometimes there is TV timeouts. So
yeah, oh yeah, the media timeout, true as well. I was just, we'd meet out onto the court. Our players would come in, and I would just tell you how I'm seeing the game right now. Here's where we're at. Here's some options offensively. Here's what they're doing defensively. Here, and then as part of my job, I kind of controlled most of the defensive matchups. So either telling you some of the matchups I'd like to do or some things, or just basically telling our guys as they came in or when they were leaving or kind of on the fly, here's, we want X player of ours covering that player for them, because from scouting, you know, here's their strongest players. We want to make sure our matchups are good. Or are we switching on this play? How are we, they're running a cross screen down low. How are we defending that? Or we, something they've started to run that we never saw in the scout might be happening. So, okay, so we got to be able to adapt. How are we going to defend that piece of action on the fly? So there were so many things going on. I found myself exhausted mentally at the end of the games, but it was a good exhaustion. And I found I was so mentally focused because there were so many things going on that the games went by very quickly for me, because I was just so focused on things. And I don't know, to coin a common term, almost in the zone, right? There were so many things to focus on. So I found at the end of the game, there was just this, I looked forward to this relief at the end of the game mentally, and then I wanted to decompress for a little while, and then had to get back to scouting or our schedule for preparation for the next game. So,
and I wonder how much of this too is because, like, we had to basically bring this team together in a really short phase with very little practice time. And honestly, so much of our development or in-game adjustments were things that our players hadn't seen before either. Like, we hadn't worked with them on, because, like, when you talked about specifically, like, new plays or new wrinkles, I know we both talked about this, is that we expected the pro players to be able to handle, and we didn't try anything wild. We just focused on really simple offensive concepts. Yep. But our players really struggled at times with handling adjustments offensively. I thought defensively they were much better at handling adjustments. And, you know, and again, it speaks to, I think you and I both within our teams, we would have had an easier time drawing up a new play for them or a wrinkle within a play than we did with these teams. And maybe that's another reason I didn't call timeouts, because I knew they couldn't handle what I thought they needed anyway. So I might as well just let them play. But yeah, no, do you notice that as well?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, the one thing too, I think, which was interesting is even some of the terminology for things that we went through. So maybe a piece of action, you called it a certain term. I called it a certain term. We had players on our team that maybe not familiar with either of those terms and had their own term for the action.
I found myself sometimes saying it three different ways.
Absolutely.
Three different words if we're talking about being in pack or, you know.
So some of that too could be lost in translation, right? Like, they may know what that is or some options on how to defend it, but we may have just been speaking a bit of a different language, and because of how fast we had to go through things, there could have just been some lost in translation there. So, like, during the games too, I'd have the coaching board and some of the guys on the bench just to eliminate some of that lost in translation. A lot of times too on the bench, I was just diagramming things to them or showing them pieces of action, so none of that lost in translation was there. We're trying to do so many things and just show them so many ways so to prepare on the fly. And that's why, you know, like I said, during the games, it was so feverish and so focused. The games went by very quickly, but so much fun, just so much fun.
And I think for coaches, I mean, the big takeaway is, and Brad and I are big language guys. We're big with the words we use to our team because the way we define things is part of our culture for our players and for our team. But I think that drove the point home even more, is how important everyone being on the same word and the same understanding is. And to be honest, it's not that we didn't value it. It's that we just didn't have time. We just didn't have time to get to that point. So, and that's where I think defensively guys were better with adjustments, because you know, like I said, on a ball screen, if we're talking about shocking it or hedging it or showing on it, I could use all three words and someone would know one of those words.
Yeah. And
that's kind of the value of some of those things. Let's get to some of the stuff that we really noticed from teams that could help coaches. And I think the first thing is how teams at the international level make you defend the whole court. Like defensively, we were stretched on basically every possession of defense to cover the whole court. What are the things that kind of you saw that I think coaches could apply from those games to be able to help coaches, you know, improve their offense from the lessons we learned?
Well, I think first and foremost, you know, and again, no real shockers or surprises here, just constantly shooters in both corners. So the first thing from every team that we saw was they love to push the ball. They love to get out in transition. Obviously, the talent was so good that bigger guards and being able to push the ball up the floor and guys that were good athletes that could run, but just constantly stretching the floor with great shooters in the corners. So not only, you know, that's first and foremost, they're going to hold the corner, put some stress on your D, and then maybe run some secondary type offensive action off of that. Just as in the pro game, really anywhere, a lot of ball screening action. So maybe some transition ball screen out of that.
Particularly ball screen and rescreen.
It was almost rescreen.
Yeah.
Especially Iran loved to do that action. They had a couple of bigs that were outstanding, and they'd have their guards run off some pin downs or some down screens, or they'd run some cross screen, down screen type screen the screen action. And then if the guard coming off that action couldn't score, then they would come right back and ball screen it again, and they'd have some shooters in the corners. And it's just really stretching your defense, putting a lot of stress on it.
Well, the other part that goes with that is that, like, clearly quick shots were the norm rather than long possessions. And some coaches will think, well, that's FIBA, you know, because it's a 24-second shot clock. But every team played fast or tried to play fast.
I think that's where defensively we most of the time did a nice job. We got teams longer into their possessions, which I don't think they were very familiar with doing, like you mentioned. And the longer the possession went on, they had to break down their man or sort of run something out of their set actions. A couple of times, too, which was really interesting, is, you know, there might be a side ball screen or a hide ball screen, but they'd run other action off ball while the ball screen was occurring. So sometimes there may be some hammer action on the weak side. Sometimes there was rarely just ever an exchange on the weak side of players. There was maybe some type of screening action, some flare action, some hammer action, some cutting off the ball coming across the top. Just always things to put your help and weak side into a position where they couldn't just sit there and gauge how good that ball screen actually is and poach in on their man or have extra help on penetration in the key, which just puts so much stress on your weak side D.
And so coaches know, I mean, the weak side action was the number one thing I took away from the tournament. Like I now will kind of think more deeply about what our weak side action is. And it wasn't just off ball screen. It wasn't just off post entry. It was sometimes as the ball was coming up the floor, like you just never had a chance on the weak side of the floor to relax. Because chances are someone's pinning you or someone's cutting or there's some type of action. And we said, I mean, Korea was one of those teams that did an outstanding job of both pinning the weak side and sending a cutter through to the ball side corner, which was, we got lost a few times on that. And the weak side action was tremendous. But let's circle back.
Just one last point on that too. I always think as a coach, when you're running ball screen action, if you have weak side action off that ball screen, your spacing may not be great, right? And the timing and spacing may be a detriment to your ball screen action.
Or you're not ready to shoot.
Yeah, you're not ready to shoot, or the ball screens get, the dribbler's getting into the paint, and there's two guys standing there running some flare screen action, and their men are just right there able to help on the penetration, or their spacing's just poor. That was rare. That was very rare in some of the actions that we saw. And it was run at such a high pace that it was tough to defend. And one last takeaway from that, too, is everything was run so quickly, and you'd expect that from higher level players, that there was just nothing run terribly slow, nothing without any tremendous pace on it, and just putting so much stress on your defense to make quick decisions was really nice to see.
Well, and I'm going to try and get some of the coaches on to talk about some of the speed of the actions and stuff like that, because I thought it was tremendous, some of the different styles, and but they all were purposeful in their cuts and purposeful in their movement. So, Coach, we mentioned there it was like too much action from other teams helped us defensively. That sometimes they'd try and run all these masking or false motions, and for us being longer, more athletic, that gave us more opportunities to disrupt. And I'm wondering, in circling back, if that was part of the reason that we got teams later into the shot clock. That and switching, which we went in with a mindset that we wanted to switch as much as possible in our short prep time. That would help us, obviously, but also to take advantage of our length. But that's some of the reason that our defense was more effective and probably was, in all certainty, what won us the tournament, even though we had some pretty good offensive performances. The defense was the difference.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think one of the things we were different at than other teams was, as you mentioned, we made teams go later into the clock. We might have been a little bit more athletic. We were definitely longer. And on the flip side of that, too, I think we were able to break teams down a little bit more offensively off the dribble. We'd run a simple piece of action, but then we were just going to go at you off that action. And I found a lot of teams tried to stay within their actions and not necessarily really break you down off the actions that they ran. And, you know, so I don't think at all, I hope you would agree, that I don't really think we had better like one-on-one players, so to speak. I mean, the talent of a lot of these teams was tremendous, but they almost seemed more disciplined to want to continuing to run action throughout their sets, whereas we would run action and run a piece of action, and then now we're going to really attack you and get the ball in the paint or put some stress on your D and attack, and really put some stress individually on your defense now to break down the rest of your team defense. Whereas I found, not to say that all the teams didn't do that at some point, but I felt we did that a lot more, and as a result, our defensive possessions went longer, which, like you said, helped us. And it'd just be a matter of rebounding at that point, which we did a solid job on the defensive glass.
Well, for me, it comes back to, like, if you watched our games on offense, you would never look at anything we ran and say, wow, that's great. I'd really like to run that action, or I'd like to steal that action, or anything like that. And I think gradually, you and I both relinquished our thought process in terms of, oh, let's run this really amazing action. And it was just like, okay, let's get right to the point. Yeah. Get right to the point. Like, whoever it's going to be, whether it's through a ball screen or some type of simple bring them off a high down screen. And just permission may be the wrong word, but it's true. Give our players permission to attack when they have opportunity. And that's why I think so much of what we did on offense was just focusing on being in space and not screwing up people's space. And if we did that, then we were much better on offense, no matter what the offense looked like prior to the final actions.
Oh yeah. And outside of our defense, that was the other key, I think, too, was our spacing. And we had enough shooters to really stretch the floor, put some great spacing on teams, and being able to shoot the three well. You know, we had some bigs in the corners that shot the ball relatively well as well, and just being able to stress that. So a lot of running a little piece of action, breaking down your man, and then reading the defense after that was a big key to our success for sure.
Well, you said it in your notes, but it was about one-hand finishes on penetration. That, and there's certainly a lot more one-hand passing, but the one-hand finishes, I've been reflecting on this, and actually I've incorporated it more into my camp teaching when I teach young people now since I've been back, because I noticed that it makes sense for smaller players, which again, a lot of times we played against, you know, really skilled players, but they were smaller, they weren't as athletic. And the one-hand finish where they literally don't necessarily jump off the floor, they're more just releasing it off the dribble off one hand, that really changed timing. And I think there were so many games where you and I would look and go, that's a heck of a play. They'd make layups where they knew that because of their size or because of their athleticism, they weren't getting all the way to the rim for a traditional 1-foot layup finish. that they have to find ways either off of fades or off of scoops or off of different things to be able to score around the basket, but not at the rim. And I was really impressed watching that.
It was very Rondo-like, you know, to steal a reference. It was very like goofy-footed floaters, a lot of inside hand finishes, right? Like tons of penetration and floating and inside hand finishes. Just so much creativity. And, you know, as coaches, I think sometimes we're so particular with fundamentals. You know, your layup's got to be this way, and you've got to make sure you're protecting the ball with the inside shoulder. And here are three type of layups you should shoot. How many layups, as you mentioned, we saw in that tournament, you're just kind of like, that was just strange. Or it looked quote unquote unfundamental or not proper. And it was impressive, or high finishes off the window, and just the creativity to finish around the basket, which, as you mentioned, is required because the size is so good inside that you have to find crafty ways to be able to finish and score, or you're just going to be very ineffective.
Well, and I teach this, and no surprise for people that, you know, it's part of my messy learning approach, but to defundamentalize players, like basically they've been taught this rigid methodology in terms of shooting a layup or shooting a 2-foot shot. And as you move up in levels, but I even at youth camps, I try and defundamentalize them. And we do something called perceptual layups. And I'll share a video of this once I get it edited at some point, but, and it may be up by the time I release the podcast, but it's essentially a player's moving towards me as I'm passing the ball towards them. And the defender is instructed to just step forward, step to his side and stand there. And the player coming in on the layup has to first, maybe they evade the defender, maybe they don't, depending on which direction the defender steps, but they have to first focus on the defender, then they have to focus on the rim. And what I'm finding is that it's never that stereotypical layup. So a player is forced to, in self-discovery or whatever it is, to find options that work. So
we also say that, but I found too with some of that in the modern day finishing and with floaters and runners being so prevalent, I find, especially with my guys, is I don't think we get fouled enough going to the basket on a lot of that stuff. But I felt in the Jones Cup tournament, they were still doing those creative finishes, but they were drawing fouls, right? Would you agree with that?
Listen, FIBA officiating, I think you and I both left that tournament saying we were very impressed with the officiating, except for the one thing was the soft end one seemed to be the favorable call, right? Yes, like if you're hit hard almost on a layup and you didn't finish, we found you didn't get the call. Yeah. If you did finish it, you got the call. And it was just really interesting. But otherwise, generally, I mean, in that tournament, over the tournament, I mean, generally they let you play pretty physical. That one contact wasn't going to cause a foul. But stuff at the rim, yeah, it was very interesting. But you're right. Like those players were crafty and still had the ability to get a call.
Yeah, that principle of verticality on a lot of those finishes, too, may have been a bit of a stretch at times. There's a lot of contact going to the rim. And like you said, soft and ones, like brush, phantom stuff and ones. But sometimes there was like some pretty hard body fouls. They're going to call the blocking or hand foul, but a lot of the body stuff they really let go. But it was consistent.
You know, I think we both would love to have those officials in the main sense that they didn't speak that much English. So I couldn't really worry about ever trying to get a call. Like I could coach the game more because it didn't matter what I said to them. They didn't understand.
That was such an interesting dynamic of how much less complaining you do because the referees don't understand what you're saying. So it just becomes so futile. So you just give up doing it. It was pretty refreshing.
I enjoyed every part of that. I'll be honest. I enjoyed every part of it. I'll try to do less this year and just treat every official as someone from the Asian countries that doesn't speak English. How about that? But the other part we both talked about is that how well-behaved is the wrong term. I mean, we're talking about adults, but how focused on coaching the coaches were. Like I was really impressed with the coaching overall, that not just what they run, but how the coaches approached it and, you know, kind of the demeanor that I aspire to in a lot of ways, that particularly if we talk about the Korean coach. That guy looked as chill as you could possibly look on the sideline. Like, and I was just like, man, that's really cool. Because that's kind of how I want to act when I coach, is I want to be chill. And just, again, part of me is better analysis of the game, the more chill I am. So what are your thoughts overall on the level of coaching?
Yeah, no, the level of coaching was outstanding. I'm not too sure what their preparation time was, if they were together for a long time before the tournament or had a very quick preparation time like we did.
Well, I'll tell you this about the Philippines. The Philippines team only takes 1 month off a year, basically, that they have a full year team that runs. So they took, say, January off, I think is what they told me. So they had a full year team together. So that's a lot.
Well, they looked like it too, right?
They looked like it.
They were definitely the team that looked like that and had been together the longest. They ran the most stuff. They were a well-oiled machine when we were looking at it, for sure. But yeah, no, the staffs were great, and a lot of really good stuff that they ran. Some of it in clips and things you've put up on Immersion, I know, and I'm sure continued will to do, which is great stuff. And, you know, well-behaved. Hardly any technicals in that tournament, I think, right? Technical fouls.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing coaches, right?
Yes.
And for the record, you and I didn't get any technicals. So
Well, I guess I wasn't going to get one for sure, but you shouldn't have got one. And if I did get one, it would have been blamed on you anyway. So
that's great. The only area of coaching that I would argue was probably surprising to me was how little creativity there was on inbound. Like, there were a few kind of good sideline plays, you know, that kind of gave us some trouble. But really on inbound, there was very little that was creative.
And one comment we had during the tournament, too, was, and I, like we said, preparation time, I'm sure, is key on these kind of things, how many things you can put in. But to your point, a lot of teams hardly had more than one or two out of bounds plays either, right? So from a preparation standpoint, that was a bit easier. I guess we had one with a couple of options that was barely run either. So
part of that. And, you know, again, the focus was mainly get the ball in and then run an action once the ball's in, rather than trying to score off of, if coaches want to think like some type of pick or weak side, let's try and get a layup.
Hardly any direct score off the inbound passer. There'd be definitely be at least two passes in most cases before some piece of action would be run after it. A lot of ball screen on entry right after an inbound play to try and look at it. I'm not sure if you want to touch on this later or not either as part of my points, but especially inbound, I don't know. One of my things, and maybe I should get away from it, but I'm always looking from an out-of-bounds play perspective, especially on the end line, I'm always looking to get something inside first, you know, something cheap and toward the basket. And in a lot of the cases in this tournament, that was never even an option.
No, we didn't have to defend the weak side really much. Yeah.
Yeah, it was perimeter action to like get somebody open and then run something on the perimeter. So you hardly had to defend your basket, or they hardly put any stress for layups or situations around the basket, which was kind of surprising to me, to be honest. But just post play in general was completely absent, other than Korea with Ricardo Ratliff, who was an absolute beast inside.
Best player in the tournament, by the way. And
killed us, obviously. I think he had 32 and 15 or something against us, which was amazing. But no one threw the ball inside. I mean, that's obviously the trend of today's current game. But from inbound plays to just regular sets to even on the break, other than penetrating the ball into the paint, Ratliff was really the only player from Korea that got back to the basket touches inside. Thoughts on that?
No, it was so true. I mean, and I did find too, like the few teams that threw it into the post, like direct into the post, they really threw it in there to try and run action out of the post, like dribble handoffs or some type of weak side action, you know, and almost like it wasn't really to try and score in the post. So you didn't have to defend the post very often.
They used it as a passing spot.
Now, where they did try and throw it in the post was off of ball screens. And this gets into, I think, again, something that we discussed at length being there, how few adjustments were made to within games, we thought, to some of the defensive things that we did. And I can't speak within other games, but teams tended to have, if they were rolling, they were rolling, right? If they were flaring, they were flaring. And it almost seemed, at a point, predictable within the play, so that our defense didn't have to adjust as much to them adjusting on versus the ball screen defense, if that makes sense to coaches.
Yeah, and what you're saying too is the reads off of the ball screen stuff wasn't really there. I think about us defensively during a lot of games, which credit to our players, we switched up our ball screen coverages as much as we could at times in some games. So from us changing our defenses, whether we were dropping and going over the top, you know, whether we were switching on it, sometimes we changed the level of our drop. Sometimes against in a game versus Iran in particular, we were dropping and their one all-star in the tournament, he had enough daylight to shoot because we were trying to go over the top on him on the ball screen, but he had daylight to shoot. So we brought our post up a little bit to show him another body to take some of his space away. But sometimes, I remember one game later in the tournament, it might have been versus Japan, we really dropped our big even further down into the paint. But like you said, we didn't really see a ton of offensive adjustments to make us pay for that, which we found kind of shocking. And there were so many skilled bigs in that tournament and bigs that could shoot the ball, but I didn't feel there was a lot of stress put on our defense from ball screen action for those bigs to be shooters.
Right, for us to have to rotate the weak side to cover a big or to bluff from the weak side to cover a big on a flare or something, yeah. And I think we all noticed that, and that was interesting. And again, as we've alluded to, this isn't criticism of coaching. It was more maybe a reflection of short preparation time. But it's also, you know, some of these teams are in certain philosophical phases of their development because you're playing against A or B national teams that have a bigger picture, whether it's qualifying for the Olympics or it's movement towards Asian Games, which were later in the summer, or different things like that. And so certainly we don't know the mindset of some of those teams in terms of that. But that was definitely something we noticed. The stress on the ball screen defense was not always put there by the offense. And
on the flip side of that, we saw any side ball screen, tons of icer downing the ball screen, I think, too. I mean, almost every single team did that.
Well, I was going to ask you about what you come away with that maybe helps your coaching or helps someone else coaching from now watching a ton of ball screen defense at that level. Does, you know, whether it's us or other teams, like, does it change your mindset or pretty much, again, nothing really changed?
Well, a little bit, I think. And the one thing is, obviously, you know, the levels of play, this was a level of play up from what we deal with when dealing with pro players, and they're just more skilled. So I think coming away from what I saw in the tournament is, at our level, we have a couple of different ways of defending ball screen. We kind of have option A, and then we'll have option B and option C and some different things. And it depends on personnel. But at this level and with this quality of player, you have to have a multitude of different options to play ball screen. And a lot of it is going to depend on your personnel. You're playing a big out there who may not defend the perimeter that well. Your options may be a little limited, or you may have to have more guys involved in rotation. It's just that constant chess game that is occurring. So where a lot of those teams were icing or downing side ball screen, you're going to have a few different options for sure to play that, or they should continue to kill you on it. Now, as we mentioned a little bit, there wasn't a whole lot of adjustment going on some of that stuff, but I don't think we really saw anything brand new or crazy from a ball screen defensive perspective, but just very common trends, I think, what we're seeing in North America as well, we saw over there a lot. Like, I don't know, during the course of our seasons, right, like that we play in the same league, almost everyone was icing and or downing side ball screen as well, and we saw that over there. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I would totally agree. And, you know, I guess, again, like, so much of it was familiar in a lot of ways and so much of it was not. But I think for you and I mean, could there be anything more stimulating for us as a coach than experiencing 8 games in 9 days with different philosophies and different types of coaches? But also, I think we've talked about that a little bit. Also, I think just the culture of basketball in Taiwan. Wasn't it incredible to you just to be in that environment and see how much, you know, whether it's fans or players or just how well everyone was treated, but how well the game was respected and celebrated? It was an amazing atmosphere.
Someone was asking me about that the other day, and I found myself explaining it that they're just crazy about basketball. They love basketball. in Taipei where we were. They wanted to interact so much with the players on our team and other players in the tournament, not only their own home team, but they were very polite. They even, like, they rarely cheered against the team. And some of the games in that tournament had such a great atmosphere, but they were just so polite and nice in their atmosphere, which was also interesting. You know, like, I go to Windsor and play, and obviously we're rivals. I may be called a few choice words, and I'm sure vice versa with you. Well,
that's only by me to you.
I know over there there's obviously a language difference, although lots of English. It was amazing how much English a little bit people spoke here and there to kind of get by and help the communication with us for sure. But just how polite and excited they were. They just loved watching. They loved seeing talent and great plays, and they appreciated things that your team did. And I mean, what an amazing experience. We're talking from a coaching perspective, obviously, but from a playing perspective, I mean, that's just something you'll never forget. It was unreal to play in that environment. It must have been even better.
Well, and I want coaches to know, it wasn't just us against Iran. It was us against the Taiwan teams, where fans would be applauding our plays and just, again, just being genuinely excited for the game of basketball. And it was really, to me, it was what competition would be in my mind, because it would make the whole experience for everyone more enjoyable. If fans would just, you know, I get cheering for your own team. I'm not saying that, but certainly enjoying the level of competition. And that was tremendous to be a part of.
Well, yeah, like I said, too, I think here in North America, we get a little bit more of cheering against the other team as part of the experience. Now, maybe the tournament we were in really wasn't conducive to that, but there was none of that. And I also found, which was really amazing, was how cool the teams were with one another. There was a real, like, I don't know if any of our guys really knew any of the players on any of the other teams, but maybe because we're in the same hotel and sometimes they'd even eat in close proximity to one another at the dining area. But there became a real appreciation between the players, and our guys exchanged some things and shirts and whatnot with other players. And they didn't even speak the same language, but there was a real appreciation and almost brotherhood that kind of developed between players in the tournament, as indicated by that final picture our team took. So that ending ceremony we had, and, you know, obviously we were lucky enough to be champions of the tournament. And we were going to take a picture at center court by the 40th Jones Cup logo. And then all of a sudden, Korea and Iran just joined right into our picture. And everyone was cool with it and thought it was amazing. You know, just such a brotherhood overall was something really interesting to see. And maybe wouldn't really happen so much in a North American setting, right?
But it should. Even from the way the formalities of different things or the informalities of different things, I just think they just have such a cool approach to competition. And I think that's reflected, I assume, in all Asian games, but maybe it's more conducive to FIBA. I don't know, but it was wonderful to be a part of. And again, it's what I would reflect competition should be, that we enjoy it. Now, I also want coaches to know that Brad and I were both surprised that we won the tournament. We were surprised because obviously you go into a certain tournament with certain expectations, and it wasn't an expectation that we weren't potentially good. It was that we thought other teams would be very good, and we didn't know if we'd be prepared for a lot of things that would come our way. And again, it comes back to this coaching paranoia, that we kind of always are in this state of mind of paranoia that we won't be prepared for something. But it really, again, painted a picture to me of that sometimes you just got to figure it out. And it wasn't that easy to figure out, though, was it? Managing players was the most challenging part of this whole process. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. And we're talking about our coaching expectations. We only had three players that had played in it the year before. So we had a lot of guys who, what were their expectations? What were their individual expectations? What were their team expectations? And managing all that. And we were new to the situation as well. So that first game we played against Chinese Taipei B team, and I would probably say we didn't play very well and were luckily able to win that game in the final stretches of that game. That was a real feeling out process, I think, for everybody, coaches, players, having just got off the plane a few hours before the next day and having a 12-hour time difference turnaround was really a strange experience, but we were able to power through that game somehow. One of the biggest things too, I really like the compete level of our guys. Our guys' compete level was off the chart, and I think that really helped to carry us through a lot of this preparation. And there was never really a point I felt as a coach that our guys didn't think they could win. You know, I don't know. Against Korea might have been the only game where we got down kind of a decent amount of double-digit deficit, or Korea was played so well in that game against us and they were so good. But our guys always thought they could win. And there was never really any doubt that, you know, oh, yeah, we'll go on a little stretch here. We'll chip away. We'll do this. That was really exciting to be a part of, just that belief in themselves. And I think as the tournament went on and we got our steam and got our wind behind our sails, so to speak, as the tournament went on, there was more belief in our team that we were going to win and just do whatever it took, no matter how much we were down.
I agreed. And it was reflected in our starts that really very few games we were ever down because we had such great starts. And that was a level of professionalism that, again, you know that we didn't control every aspect of our players. So some of the things that they did off the court, you or I might think that didn't prepare them the best for the game. And that kind of, again, for a coach, you kind of worry about those things. But once I think there was a trust that these guys really, again, they just showed up and they hooped, as we said.
And another thing I thought too, just touching on another point, which was interesting from a defensive perspective, was not a whole lot of zone defense in that tournament.
No, but you talked about how they extended, right? They extended their zone quite a bit when they did, right?
Oh, yeah. But when we did see some zone or extended stretches of zone, let's say it was like an average 2-3 zone, it was basically a 3-2 zone. The wings were so high. And we obviously here, when we're coaching, we see all kinds of different zones, but maybe it's a fact of kind of FIBA or whatever, I'm not sure. We don't usually see a lot of true zones where guys aren't trying to play people or they're trying to play two guys more often than not. But I think in this tournament, the wings of the zone, they never really tried to play anybody. They just tried to stay really high in space and try to mess up your rhythm and your passing, which was not something I've seen very often or don't see much in our league or kind of around North America. We usually match up a little bit more on the wing or kind of bump off, right? In traditional kind of Syracuse 2-3 zone style. They would just try to play at sometimes it was almost in no man's land or just try to push the ball up so high and sit in an area. I found that kind of interesting.
Well, and one of the players, I remember him saying to me, "Coach, it's a 1-3-1. It's a 1-3-1." And I'm like, no matter what it is, just play because, you know, we don't have a 1-3-1 offense anyways. But it also paints a picture. It's like, okay, to players, and we said this a few times here at the tournament, don't overthink it. If it's man or zone, it does not matter to what we're doing. Space and play. And we never wanted our players to analyze and sit there and go, okay, it's a zone, let's run this, or it's a man, let's run this. It's let's just play. Like, again, that was helpful because, again, like there were some things that teams did that maybe would be non-traditional, but it didn't matter. It didn't matter if our players spaced and played.
And to your point, you know, that's how we played against those kind of zones is we kind of did what we did. We were going to space two side on the one floor. We were going to penetrate the gaps. We were going to try to create two-on-ones against the zone, kick it to the weak side, just stuff we were doing against man. But in scouting some of these other teams, watching them play against these teams that did play zone, you know, and obviously Korea played a little bit, is they would try to run sort of their zone offense. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. And I thought that got them into more trouble than just playing within their way. So the style actually that we played, as you mentioned, with more freedom and kind of attacking and spacing served us well in that situation, where it could have been a bit of a detriment to some other teams because they would actually have a set or something that they ran against it specifically, and it maybe took them out of some flow, or the way that defensive wing was playing took them out of some things and it could force them to go longer into possessions.
Well, and I'm all into that because, again, you may play zone against me all year now, but like we really don't have a zone offense and we don't spend much time on zone offense because I've always said it. If you learn how to play – whether it's against man or maybe you can practice all against zone. I don't know why you would, but if you learn how to play, it doesn't matter what the defense is because it's, again, it's just space and play. And, you know, we have a few little sets against zone that we'll run occasionally, but we don't really have a zone offense. Like, we want our players to play. And two-side and different things you said is perfect for zone because, again, it overloads the one side and creates that 2-1 advantage. So
absolutely.
It was really neat to see. So, Coach, one other thing. Coaches have to understand this. And a physiologist told me a long time ago, and I believe it even more so, a travel day is not an off day. Even if you're not on the court, a travel day is not an off day, especially when you're talking about 15, 16 hours on an airplane. Like, that is a work day. And that would have been ideal if we had a day off the next day or something like that to help our players with recovery, but we didn't. But what are your experiences now having taken such a long flight?
Oh, I've never been on a flight of that length before. And I think a couple of things that I remember from that flight was, you know, we went from Toronto to Vancouver to Taipei. So Toronto to Vancouver was what, about 4 hours
or so?
And then the Vancouver to Taipei flight was 14 hours. Was that right?
Yeah, a little bit under that, I think.
Yeah, 13 and change maybe. But I remember on the way there, you know, sitting in my seat and doing a bunch of things and killing time. And then all of a sudden I'm like, you know what? This isn't that bad. I think I've killed a lot of time. And then looking up at the screen and we still have 5 hours left. And then I'm just kind of rattled by it and trying to get through it. And as you're killing time and someone who doesn't sleep very well and like moving vehicles. So I was up for a long time and had a lot of time to think inside my own head. I'm thinking, you know, when you're on the plane and that screen comes up and they show you where you went from and where you're going to, and they show
it off.
But you know, they have the plane,
they show you
the plane. Why is the plane so out of proportion? You know what I mean? It's like that big plane is getting closer to Taipei, but we're still 5 hours away. But I'm like, I'm looking, the plane's so big, it looks like we're an hour away. And it was driving me insane.
Coaches can now understand why Brad is such a good coach because he gets obsessed with the little details. That's tremendous. Well, again, Coach Campbell, thank you so much for not only joining the podcast, but helping me in Taiwan with 3D Global Sports. And big shout out to Teddy, who put the whole thing together for us and helped us with that opportunity. And Mark Jablonski, the other assistant that joined us. And again, and a big shout out to Coco in Indonesia, was another coach that joined us as part of a coaching development program that was a part of this as well. And for you and I, it's an experience that we'll never forget. And tremendous network built out of it, but also tremendous learning experience. And hopefully other coaches get some benefit from this conversation to think more about reflectively some of the experiences they've had or some of the experiences that they can bring to their team as well, because there's nothing better for travel than open your eyes and open your players' eyes about the experiences that exist in the world.
What an amazing experience. Still think about it daily, obviously, and just such an eye-opener to basketball around the world. And, you know, we live in our own little bubble. Well, I do anyway, for sure. And just to get outside of that bubble and see basketball in a different culture, in a different part of the world, and how much they love it and how exciting it was, and just the other possibilities of everyone in the world's playing this game, and it's growing at such an immense rate, especially not only here in Canada, but around the world, and just such an eye-opener for all kinds of reasons. But yeah, big shout out to Teddy and 3D Global Sports to have that opportunity. And I want to thank you a lot too, Chris, for having me aboard for this opportunity. And, you know, we can go back to being rivals again, I guess, but what an amazing opportunity and experience, and something I'll definitely remember the rest of my life for sure.
Amazing. Wonderful. All right. Thanks, Coach Campbell, and everyone enjoy your day. To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.